Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Let's talk now with the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. All the polling suggests, if an election were held today, Mr. Pierre Poilievre would become the Prime Minister of this country in short order. Mr. Poilievre, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Green.
Let's start on the safe drug supply issue. That was a big issue in Parliament earlier this week, and it's a huge issue nationally, not just in British Columbia. What is your bottom line sense of this program? What do you think needs to be done?
Well, first of all, we have to stop using the government's lies. It's not safe supply. That's just the government propaganda language, and it is a falsehood. It is unsafe. It is they're giving out heroin-grade opioids paid for by your tax dollars. We now know for a fact that large amounts of those opioids are resold into high schools, given to kids. Those kids then risk overdose. Furthermore, they graduate to even more dangerous fentanyl. And since this experiment of giving out tax-funded drugs began, we've seen over a 200% increase in overdose deaths. So Justin Trudeau says he's interested in following the evidence. Well, the evidence is that he's killing people with this policy of giving out drugs. 40,000 have died since he became prime minister. I will end this program of paying for unsafe opioids and instead put the money into treatment and recovery services to bring our loved ones home drug-free.
Are you crossing over into provincial territory? Not that I disagree with you, but are you crossing over into provincial territory?
No. The federal government is funding, under Justin Trudeau, is funding these programs with federal money. So I have every right to cancel these programs and redirect the money to treatment centers, directly to treatment centers that actually get people off drugs. There are literally hundreds of them. They're fantastic. They get almost no support from the government because the government doesn't want to get people off drugs. The government wants to keep people hooked so that they can keep running. These are the bureaucracies that are fed by this misery can perpetuate and expand every day and in every way. So I'm going to cut off all that bureaucracy, the radical activists, the drugs, and I'm going to put the money into backing in treatment centers that have a track record of getting people off drugs. That's common sense.
All right. That's quite an accusation, but I'm going to move on to other issues here. The Foreign Interference Public Inquiry, the preliminary report. We've just been talking to Michelle Junokatsuya, former CSIS chief of the Asia-Pacific unit, whose unit was shut down after it warned of China's interference in Canada's business. Did anything really surprise you that came out of that interim report?
No. It's everything I've been saying all along, which is that Justin Trudeau has made Canada into a playground for foreign interference. And that's because he benefits from that interference. The Chinese government has tried to keep Trudeau in power in both 2019 and 2021 because he shares their ideology. He, of course, famously said that he admires China's basic communist dictatorship, and he's never retracted that. And since that time, we found that Beijing has intervened to try and keep him in power. And he knew about it. He was briefed on it. He did absolutely nothing. And the report found that he, in cases where he did know of evidence of foreign interference, he didn't intervene because he was worried that doing so would hurt his election chances. So he put himself ahead of the country's democracy, as he always does. It's yet another reason why Justin Trudeau is not worth the cost, the crime, the corruption, and we need a new common sense prime minister.
Mr. Poilievre, you wrote an op-ed that appeared in the National Post in which you challenge corporations and umbrella organizations to change how they deal with the federal government for the betterment of Canadian citizens. What are you telling us?
I'm telling businesses to fire their lobbyists. We have these useless money-sucking lobbyists on Parliament Hill who basically suck up to the Liberal government while the government attacks entrepreneurs, investors, and by consequence, workers. And it hasn't worked. I mean, the reason that Trudeau is able to continue attacking our employers is because there's no political consequence. The worst that will happen is his ministers will get yet another lunch invite to the ritzy Rito Club to have a conversation. And that doesn't work. They need to bring their message right to the Canadian people. And I've said to these businesses, if you want me to consider implementing your policies, you need to convince the trucker in Fort Alberni or the welder in Trois-Rivières or the single mom waitress in Barrie that it's good for them. And when they tell me they want it, then I will do it, but not until then, because we're going to be a party that's on the side of the common people and not the Ottawa lobbyists.
Let me ask you about the university encampments. We have another one that's going to start next week at the University of Manitoba, where we understand we have them in Quebec and Ontario at this juncture. What would you do about this? How do you interpret what's going on?
Look, this is a logical consequence of the divisive woke agenda that has turned people against each other, grouped them by ethnicity and religion, and then turned them against each other. Our university campuses have been pushing this Trudeauian idea of wokeism that divides people against each other and pushes radicalism. And it's not surprising that here and now we have these radical ideologies metastasizing into anti-Semitic encampments, protests, fire bombings of synagogues, things we never would have imagined we'd see in Canada before Trudeau. We've got to stop dividing by race, by ethnicity, by religion, and start uniting our people around a common Canadian value of individual freedom and responsibility.
So I just want to be sure of something that I think you said about 2 minutes ago. And did you say that Trudeau is intentionally funding illicit drug use to benefit the Liberal Party, or did I misunderstand?
I think the way I would put it is that these bureaucracies, active agencies, and interest groups that are getting the federal funding have a vested interest in keeping the problem going. The last thing that they would want is to have their funding ended. And so everything they do seems to be designed to perpetuate and worsen the problem. And in that regard, they have succeeded. They have worsened the problem. Everywhere in Canada where this money is being handed out, everywhere, the problem is getting worse. The encampments are growing. The downtown east side used to be a very unique and unusual place. Now, those types of encampments exist on Vancouver Island, in the British Columbia interior, all across the towns and cities of Ontario. But we never had this before. But, you know, there are all of these interest groups that want to perpetuate the cycle because that's how they get their money. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I'm going to cut off these interest groups and put the money into treatment and recovery to bring our loved ones home drug-free.
We're going to have an election. Maybe later this year, Mr. Trudeau says it'll be.
I just want to say something else. What is this wacko thinking? Like, it's been.
Am I supposed to expel you from this program now?
you are, actually. But, like, you know, people are upset that I'm using language like that. What else do you. How else do you describe it when 2,500 people die in the year that follows the decriminalization of these hard drugs in BC? The BC government, which is an NDP government, says this was a total mistake. We need to reverse it. And now, 10 days later, Trudeau is still not reversing it. He is allowing people to smoke meth in hospital rooms and blow the fumes in the face of nurses who have to get home and breastfeed their kids in parks where children play. It is legal to smoke crack and shoot up heroin. And he's had 10 days since the provincial government has asked him to reverse this, and he still hasn't done it.
Yeah. Mr. Polyev, good talking to you, and I'm not going to expel you. You can say wacko anytime you want on this program.
Axe the tax, build the homes, fix the budget, stop the crime.
Thanks for the time. Thanks. The public inquiry into foreign read China election interference in this country. Michelle Juno Katsuya is with us, former CSIS chief of the Asia-Pacific unit. And following Michelle's warning of Chinese interference in this country, and we've talked about this with him, his CSIS unit was not praised, wasn't thanked, wasn't given broader responsibility. No, they were shut down. Michelle Juno Katsuya wrote the preface and the afterword for The Mosaic Effect, How the Chinese Communist Party Started a Hybrid War in America's Backyard. Welcome back, Michelle. Thank you for the time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. Always been good to be with you.
So Justice Hogue, in her preliminary report on foreign interference, called interference, quote, a stain on our electoral process, end quote, and said it would continue unless vigorous steps are taken to counter the interference. She didn't receive all the documentation from the federal government that she should have, and she pointed to the Don Valley North riding in Toronto, where in 2019, during the nomination process for Han Dong, the Liberal candidate, for whom it is alleged busloads of students were brought in to vote for Mr. Dong, she pointed to that. And there was concern among the students, we understand, that their visas were threatened if they failed to participate. Was this standard operating procedure?
Yeah, we need to be precise. That they were Chinese foreign children. They were not Canadian students. They were Chinese foreign students. And no, it's not a standard procedure yet. In that perspective, what was said over and over by Mr. Trudeau, by his staff, by other political personnel, that, busloads coming to a nomination night or during election day, it's common, it's a practice that we have, we didn't pay attention. Well, CSIS brought it to the attention of the Prime Minister, and that's one of the things that was neglected to a certain extent by the Prime Minister. Why was it neglected? Probably because it served his purpose to a certain extent to have the person he wanted in place. And this is what the inquiry needs to work on now. It needs to be a little bit more precise. When we read the report, and I read the report, it's very well written in order to not sort of try to find any guilty party, because that's not its job neither. The inquiry is not there to judge or to find somebody guilty of anything. It's to try to understand exactly what took place. And to summarize what took place and what she confirms, the Justice Hogs confirms herself, is that, yes, the integrity of the electoral system was at stake, but for in her perspective, it was not undermined. Did it have any impact on the overall election 2019-2020? She said no. Did it have impact in certain writings? She believes so, although she's not capable to come with a firm declaration on that because she doesn't have sort of hardcore evidence. That said, what we need to understand here is that the Chinese intelligence service and the Chinese government were not trying to take over the Canadian electoral system. They were just trying to sort of be able to place people into power, into the cabinet, being capable to be agent of influence eventually that would influence the decision process in this country. So it does have an impact on our electoral ecosystem, definitely. It definitely also undermines the public confidence that the people needs and must have in our electoral system, and definitely affected certain community, particularly the community where the diaspora of certain countries, because not only China is under scrutiny here, but there's other countries like India and Russia. And in both cases, she found that there was evidence presented to her that, yes, indeed, those countries have been meddling with our electoral system. So at the end of the day, we're getting the information that close to 400 witnesses have been giving for the last year or so that, yes, indeed, the foreign interference is a problem in Canada, and yet we still need to see tangible action coming from this government to sort of curb and to protect us.
Yeah, I found it interesting and disturbing that during testimony of the inquiry, Mr. Trudeau and other senior liberals said they were aware of the allegations of impropriety during the nomination of Han Dong, but they didn't take action because they didn't feel the intelligence provided was sufficiently strong. Michelle, let me go back to when you, as the head of the Asia-Pacific Unit for CSIS, delivered your report. Just summarize for us, please. What did your report warn would happen?
Well, we did warn because we found evidence at that time that our prime ministers, and at that period of time, we had Prime Minister Mulroney and Chrétien in power, and we had found that they had been compromised through various means, and we had evidence, we had statement, we had everything to prove what our allegations. What we were capable to prove later on in the years that followed is that every single prime minister, including Mr. Harper, Mr. Martin, were informed that there was Chinese foreign interference taking place, and they all decided to either use it for their personal gain or for their partisan gain. And that is a direct violation of the power they were invested into and the responsibility they were given to be prime minister of this country. And that is the power of foreign interference and the clandestine element that goes into play when these guys are doing it. So in our time, we had evidence. We've had demonstrated. We didn't have evidence that the embassy, the Chinese embassy, had given money back in 1995, and that was in the report of Election Canada, both to both parties, the Liberals and the Conservatives. So somewhere, somehow, from an intelligence point of view, when we look at the entire last 30 years, what we are witnessing is that no parties have been immune to this foreign interference. No party have been taking it seriously, or worse, in some cases, we have evidence that they used it for their own gain. And that is what is at stake in this inquiry and this situation as we speak.
That is so deeply disturbing to hear. Do you have, and I want to talk to you about this situation with university encampments in a moment, but do you have hope, given what we've all found out in the last couple of days and what was suspected and talked about for some considerable period of time, and you and I talked for, well, we've been talking for years, do you have hope that the situation is going to fundamentally change, that it will improve, or is it going to be same old, pretty soon, or worse?
The challenge that we're facing collectively together is the fact that with the actions of this current government, but the previous governments as well, because the evidence is there that previous governments behaved exactly the same way, is that people have been losing trust into the institutions, losing trust into the elected officials, losing trust into democratic system at large. So my worry is, in next election, are we going to see a drop of participation and having somebody to make a difference and to listen to what the people have to say? The great challenge that, excuse me, I apologize. The great challenge that this province has, that this country has, is the power of the lobbyist that has never been controlled properly. Currently, strangely enough, but I must praise them for that, the people who have been having the most intelligent and the most solid discourse about this foreign interference issue is the Bloc Québécois. The Bloc Québécois, who knows, will never be in power, but they are the one who has been sort of asking the right question, proposing the right things to be capable to sort of protect our system. So somewhere, somehow, I want to believe that some form of leadership must come out, either intentionally or through the pressure exercised by the embarrassment that publicly the system will receive, and they will sort of do the strict minimum, which is first to define in the law what foreign interference is about. One of the reasons why we have not seen any charges laid, and the RCMP during the public inquiry has said it, no investigation has been launched. Why? Because we do not have a frame to work with, and legally investigate or prosecute eventually.
Okay.
Two, we need a registry. We need a registry of foreign agent that will be double reporting, not only reporting one way, because we have a registry for lobbyists as we speak today. They registered, and then they go have their quiet and secret meetings with ministers or with high public servant without any problem. We need to have a double registry where we have the people who will meet with the minister that says when and what they have discussed and must report that within 10 days after the meeting, but have also the person who received the meeting, who participated to the meeting, the minister or the public servant, to report as well. So you have sort of a way to keep everybody on.
So it's what's often promised and rarely delivered, transparency. Indeed. Let's talk about what's going on in America and in Canada, and that is the student encampments. Well, they're not just students. There's a lot of activity going on. Many of them aren't students at all. But it's happening in Canada at McGill, University of Toronto, UBC, the University of Ottawa, and the University of Manitoba will be next, the Fort Garry campus, next Tuesday, I believe, is the day that was mentioned. I'm just curious whether there are foreign actors involved in this particular development. Let's ask Michelle, who has all the experience. Michelle, what's your take on that? Are other countries involved? Are they seeing an opportunity and taking it?
It's not impossible. It's we have not been seen any public evidence of that. What we do know is that foreign agents have been working on the web in on both sides. And the problem is that they are capable to manipulate the mind of a lot of people. But let's look at the fact. The fact is that certain universities do have a dubious and questionable link to either organizations or companies that are in support of one side or the other, and probably more Israel because of the business component that they bring. From an intelligence point of view, the other core preoccupation that I would have is that if we dismantle the campus, the camp, you eliminate a certain pressure valve that is currently helping society to sort of deal with this issue without extremism or violence, because those campmen have not been violent so far. Okay.
In the U.S.
The annoyance.
In the U.S. And we have about 30 seconds. So, a lot of universities do have connections with China.
Yes, yes, indeed. A lot of universities
It just seemed very interesting to me.
Most questionable one.
Yeah. But your sense is, and I'm sorry to rush you, but your sense is probably not, but we don't have evidence either way.
We don't have any evidence either way. Definitely, things are happening on the social media, and
okay.
Definitely there is inaction coming from the government that is sort of annoying and
okay.
Might call for extremism and radical actions if we dismantle those camps.
Michelle, thank you so much for your time. Thanks again.
Appreciate it, Chief.
The safe supply program. It's not just in British Columbia where they have the program. It's in other provinces as well. And there have been some really well-documented, many documented situations, cases where terrible things have happened. And now this whole idea is being revisited. Mr. Eby wants to have the safe supply program, the three-year experiment. I can't quite understand why it has to be a three-year experiment, but he wants it to continue. But at the same time, he wants police officers to have the opportunity again to interdict where interdiction is necessary. I read about my next guest, Mr. Greg Sword. It's actually last year I read about him. And I wanted to call him, and something happened. I can't remember exactly what it was, but something happened, and we never did speak with Mr. Sword. He's from British Columbia. His 14-year-old daughter, Camila, overdosed and died on hydromorphone, which it's reported her friends said they obtained from drug users who were defrauding Vancouver's Safer Drug Supply Program. And that's what Tom Stamatakis was talking about, the president of the Canadian Police Association. Here they had this program underway, but no infrastructure, or not enough infrastructure, to properly deal with it. And when a 14-year-old child dies, that's an indictment of the program and the system. And you can say what you want. You can excuse whoever you wish. You can rationalize all you want. When a 14-year-old child dies, the rationalization, the excuses end, or should. Greg, thank you so much for coming on the program, and deepest condolences to you.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining you is Eleanor Sturko. Ms. Sturko is a member of the legislature and a member of the British Columbia United Party. And Ms. Sturko has worked with Mr. Sword, and the BC United Party has been trying to do away with this safer drug supply program. Sometimes I'd like to call it something else. Ms. Sturko, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me as well.
Greg, what happened? Tell us a little bit about your daughter and what happened that allowed her to come into contact with this particularly dangerous drug that took her life.
It pretty much started during the lockdowns of COVID. She started to build up anxiety and other issues, and her outreach with her friends would start dabbling with pot, which is one thing. And then another friend introduced her to the bars, which is the street Xanax. So she started to take that. And at one point, we went from that to the Dillies. And the Dillies is what the kids all called the hydromorphine. They've supplied drugs that they would get. Their friends would go downtown Vancouver, pick up a bunch, and then just come right back to where I live. And they would just sell them to their friends. And it was a whole group of kids that were all doing them at the same time. And she had overdosed twice, once on fentanyl. And the ministry was involved. And is the most heartbreaking thing is when you're sitting in the hospital with your kid who's just overdosed and you're looking out for help, and they tell you they cannot help your child unless she verbally asks for help. And no teenage girl will ever ask a grown up for help. They think they're in control. They think they know what they're doing. So they released her, and it just continued and continued. We end up in the hospital again. And same thing. And the next one who I dealt with, she told me the only way to save my daughter was to buy a private island. And at that point, it was pretty much, trying to get my daughter straight off of drugs. And there's no programs, no help for these children who are falling through the cracks. And they're all getting addicted to this drug because they don't know how powerful it is. They think it's just like pot. I can do it and I'll be safe.
So unless your daughter at 14 would ask for help when she was in the hospital, and unless she asked, she wasn't going to get any help, correct?
Correct.
That's outrageous. I know the bureaucratic technicality around it, but it's still, to hear you say it, is an absolute outrage. And there was Dillies are Dilaudid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and there was a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
Your daughter and her friends.
Yeah.
So that's happening pretty much neighborhoods probably all over the country.
Guaranteed it.
And parents aren't even aware.
No, because it's so hard to keep track. And when the cops were involved, they kept on telling me, well, you got to pay attention to this social media. Well, kids are a hell of a lot smarter than us older people on social media. By the time we find one, they've already switched to a different one, or they've got four different accounts. And you have to work, so you can't constantly monitor what they're doing. And by the time I would get home, 5 o'clock at night, she's out with her friends. So you can't even monitor what your kids are doing anymore.
Ms. Starko, what do you have to say?
Well, you know, it's not only Camilla who unfortunately lost her life, but actually even from the friend group, and Greg knows this as well, some of the children who were involved in the same activity as Camilla continue to struggle today. One young girl whose family I know very well, even though she has been given some treatment through drug treatment regimes, she continues to struggle and use drugs, runs out into the street, because there's also a lot of now trauma that she's experienced as a result of losing her best friend. And one of the worst parts of this, Roy, is that many of the kids who are taking these drugs actually don't know that they're taking hydromorphone. I just actually spoke this morning to a very experienced and well-known addiction specialist here in BC. She had asked a student who recently graduated from high school if her and her friends ever took hydromorphone, and the girl said no. She never saw that for sale, but then the doctor asked her, did you take Dilaudid? She said no. And then when the doctor said, did you ever take Dillies? And she said, oh, of course we take Dillies. Because she had no idea that hydromorphone or Dilaudid is actually Dillies, and she thought that Dillies were safe. So the reality is that these kids are not being given any type of prevention. They're getting addicted to highly powerful opioids, and is the case with Camilla's friend who has to this point survived, and you know, she's living a very difficult and complex life, that she did graduate to using fentanyl. And her life is at risk every single day.
Yeah.
And her pathway to addiction was absolutely as a result of using diverted drugs.
You know, I'm a refugee from the 20th century. And what we did when we were kids, we'd sneak some of our parents' cigarettes if they smoked. And so we'd sneak some smokes, and the parents didn't know. And so that was... It's dangerous in the long term if you get addicted. But it's not like today. It's not like what happens with kids. And Greg, I'm sure you're correct. It's happening all over this country. So I've received a couple of emails and people were commenting on my asking where do kids get drugs. I'm not a babe in the woods. But there are people, their parents, who have no idea. There are people in this country who have no idea. I remember sitting in this studio, in this radio station, with two paramedics, and this was probably 25 years ago. And we were talking about kids and addiction to drugs during that program. And one of the paramedics said, I could take you over to a grade school here in Hamilton, Ontario, right now. And the grade 4 and grade 5 students will point out the drug dealers to you. The grade 4 and grade 5 students will point out the drug dealers to you. Text from Daryl in New Brunswick. Hi, Roy. A few years back, my buddy told me kids, even in grade school, can find any drug they wish. He was just retired as a peace officer. That's not even grade 9. Yep. That's the way it is. Greg, what is your feeling? What is your sense about this safe supply program? The whole initiative to provide these drugs to people who are addicted to drugs with the idea that ultimately it will be better for them. What's your sense of that, Greg?
I think it's the biggest joke that we have going on right now, because we are trusting drug addicts with a free supply of drugs to honor the system and to do what it's supposed to mean or to apply by taking their drugs and not doing the heroin and all that. But addicts, they want a certain high. So when you're giving them a lesser high, they're going to sell that, which is free money, to anyone who's willing to buy it, which is mostly kids. And they'll get the money, they'll buy the heroin that they want. And now we got more addicts on the street. And we have no programs to help these people. And we're just letting them fall through the cracks. So we got all these kids who are addicts, have no hope, nowhere to turn to. They're going to end up on the street. They're going to start doing a supply of the heroin, the fentanyl, to get to the next high. And how long do we have to keep on going down this road to go, you know what, this is not working. We need a better program in place.
Let me guess. You've heard from parents in BC, perhaps beyond British Columbia, after they found out about you and the tragic loss of your daughter?
I've had a few people from Ontario reach out to me and a few other parents from BC, and it's all the same story.
It's tragic. It's an absolute tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy. Masterko, your party, your political party, BC United Party, you've argued against this safer drug policy. And what's the political argument? What's the argument you've put forward?
So, you know, there's going to be a role, Roy, for pharmaceutical alternatives. And in fact, in other countries, like in Switzerland, they have a model where they do provide medically supervised heroin to people with difficult-to-treat opioid use addictions. And that will be the case here in Canada as we try to help people to be stabilized and then move on to treatment medications, or in the case of those who have resistant to treatment opioid use disorders, there's a role for pharmaceutical alternatives. But first and foremost, calling these drugs safe has done a lot of damage. Kids, even adults, young adults, and people in general, I see constantly where people say, well, that's okay if these drugs get out, they're safe and they can't hurt you. So, you know, this is a good thing. They are very dangerous drugs that are highly addictive and that can lead to opioid use disorder. And you can actually, yes, you can overdose on hydromorphone. So for us, what we're calling for actually is, of course, we recognize the importance of having medical options for doctors, but let's go to a witnessed program. The problem of diversion really ramped up after 2020, when what was called the risk mitigation guidelines, allowing for these larger quantities of opioids to be taken away instead of witnessed, that we started seeing large amounts of the diversion of safe supply. And police leaders testified at the House of Commons that even though safe supply hydromorphone is only 20% of prescriptions of hydromorphone in British Columbia, it accounts for 50% of the hydromorphone that police are finding in their seizures.
Yeah, the whole issue has been so horribly mismanaged, because you've got chronic pain patients, millions in this country, Some of them are, you know, commit suicide increasingly now. I think the number of people commit suicide or have suicidal ideation because they're not permitted to have their physician-prescribed pain medications any longer, but conversely, children can obtain the drugs that take their lives. Greg, thank you. I do appreciate speaking with you. Thank you for taking the time. You're in the deepest pain that you're in. I'm sure you are helping others, and I thank you again. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you for having me,
Ms. Durko. Thank you. Good talking to you.
Thanks for including me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.